was to take place. The president, seated in the center surrounded by local business leaders and next to Mayor Daley, with whom he'd gradually developed a good relationship, started by making some comments about the economy. Then he said he would take a couple of questions. I had recommended two reporters and briefed him on the likely questions he would be asked. Deb Reichman, a White House reporter for the Associated Press, got the first crack. Do you think that the Justice Department can conduct an impartial investigation considering the political ramifications of the CIA leak, and why wouldn't a special counsel be better? There are too many leaks of classified information in Washington, the president said, and if there is a leak out of my administration, I want to know who it is. And if the person has violated law, the person will be taken care of. He added that he had confidence in the career Justice Department officials who were assigned to work on such investigations, and that he directed his administration to cooperate fully. Then the president called on Bob Kemper, since we are in his newspaper's hometown. Bob covered the White House for the Chicago Tribune and had covered the president since the 2000 campaign. Yes, let's see, Kemper, he's from Chicago, the president said. Where are you? Are you a Cubs or White Sox fan? There was laughter from those in the room. Wait a minute, that doesn't seem fair, does it? Kemper, undeterred by the president's good-natured needling, said, Yesterday we were told that Karl Rove had no role in it. Yes, the president interrupted. Have you talked to Karl, and do you have confidence in him? Kemper interjected. I don't know of anybody in my administration who leaked classified information, he said. If somebody did leak classified information, I'd like to know it, and we'll take the appropriate action. Mission accomplished. The president had made clear how seriously he took the investigation, how much he disliked leaks of classified information, and how much he wanted to get to the bottom of the matter. And he'd made clear that if anyone in his administration had been responsible for the leak, he or she would have to leave. The next morning's gaggle back at the White House signaled that the press was now turning toward a new, rumored suspect in the leak, the Vice President's Chief of Staff, Scooter Libby. Here's how it started. Just as I was ending the gaggle, John Roberts, CBS News Chief White House Correspondent, said, One more question. You said the other day, emphatically, that you had received assurances from Karl Rove that he had nothing to do with this. Have you since received similar assurances from the Vice President's Chief of Staff? John, I'm not going to go down. I made this clear the other day. I'm not going to go down a list of every single member of the staff in the White House, I said as I started moving away from the podium. That's just one name, Roberts pleaded a little sarcastically to some laughter. I continued, and there was a specific accusation made, and I responded to that, but I'm not going to go down the list from this podium. It's a short list, though, Roberts said, garnering a few more laughs as I headed out the sliding door to the lower press office. I did not have much time to sit and critique the gaggle session with my staff that morning. President Uribe of Colombia would be meeting with the president shortly. Knowing the president's penchant for punctuality, I grabbed my notepad, told my staff that we would talk more before the briefing, and walked the 20 feet or so over to the Oval for the NSC pre-brief with the president and his meeting with Uribe. As I entered the Oval staff area, I ran into Scooter Libby. He frequently represented the vice president in world leader meetings when Cheney did not attend, and we often sat next to each other. Since we were both early, I asked if I could talk to him for a minute. We both stepped back into the small entryway connecting the Oval support staff area with the waiting area in the hallway. You need to know, I said. The press is starting to ask more questions about you and whether you might have leaked Plame's name. Scooter listened carefully. I told them that I was not going to go down a list of White House staff and answer whether every staffer was involved in the leak, I continued. I want you to know why. Now that there's an investigation underway, I can't put myself in that position. I want you to know I'm not trying to leave you hanging out there to dry. Scooter expressed his appreciation for the heads up, but said little more. He seemed to be okay with my strategy, although neither he nor anyone in his position would be happy about it. But I felt I had at least done my part to make sure he got the news directly from me rather than from the media. That Saturday, October 4th, was a relaxed, casual morning for me as I lounged around my single-bedroom downtown apartment reading the Washington Post and the New York Times. I hadn't yet shaved or showered, having slept in until 7 a.m., a couple of hours later than on a weekday, and I was thinking about hitting the gym downstairs. I typically tried to enjoy my Saturday mornings from home, unless I had to go into the office. I tended to go in Sunday afternoons to get some work done ahead of the coming week. Of course, with a 24-hour news cycle, I was always on call and worked from home on weekends, even if I did not go into the office. The call from Andy Card came around 8:30 a.m. The president and vice president spoke this morning. They want you to give the press the same assurance for Scooter that you gave for Carl. I'm not a coffee drinker. I drink Diet Coke for my morning caffeine fix. I was still sipping on one, but what Andy just said jolted me more than the soft drink did. Okay, I said, not really indicating my instinctive disinclination to do what he was directing me to do. I told him that I would head into the office and talk to him more when I got there. As I showered and dressed to go to the White House, I asked myself why Scooter hadn't talked to me first if he had a problem with the approach I was taking. Based on Andy's comments, it was clear to me Scooter had enlisted the vice president to personally appeal to the president to have me publicly deny his involvement. Now that the investigation was fully underway, I didn't like the idea of singling out staff members to defend. Earlier in the week, I had spoken with Al and David, who'd advised me pretty strongly against commenting any further on matters pertaining to the investigation, including the names of individuals. I had already told the press I would not do it. And I knew if I opened the door for one, it would be virtually impossible to close it if other names started to surface. And the press would be curious why I'd asked Scooter about his involvement and why the White House wasn't asking every staff member the same question. But this was an order coming from on high. As a result, I was about to cross the line I'd drawn publicly once the investigation had gotten underway earlier in the week. After dropping my briefcase in my office, I headed over to Andy's. He was standing in front of his assistant's desk in the waiting area that his office shared with his deputies on the opposite side. I knew from Andy's terse comments on the phone that what he was saying was not really up for debate, nor did I expect him to offer any additional information about the president's telephone discussion with the vice president. To this day, I do not know what the two discussed. I'm confident from knowing the president and from our previous conversations that he did not have any knowledge about Libby, Rove, or anyone else involved in disclosing Plame's identity to reporters. President Bush would not have deliberately misled me. While I wish I could say the same about the vice president, I simply don't know for sure. Information that would become public in future legal proceedings would raise questions about the vice president's actions that he has never publicly addressed. I told Andy I would make the same public statement about Scooter as I had for Carl, provided I received the same assurance from Scooter. Andy asked what statement I had given about Carl, and I told him I had said he was neither involved in leaking Plame's identity, nor did he condone it. I told Andy that once I'd spoken with Scooter, I would call a few reporters to make sure it got out. When I got back to my office, I called a White House operator to track down Scooter. As he often did, he was traveling with Cheney, who was spending the weekend at his place in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. The conversation was short. Scooter was never one for many words anyway. He knew why I was calling, since he had instigated what I was being instructed to do. "Were you involved in the leak in any way?" I asked him. "No, absolutely not," Scooter replied. "All right," I said. "I plan to tell reporters that you did not leak the classified information, nor would you condone doing so. Is that correct?" "Yes," he replied. Then we talked about which reporters I planned to call. Scooter hung up, and I set about my disagreeable task. I called reporters for Newsweek, which I'd heard was working on a story focusing on Scooter, the AP, and the New York Times. That same day, I happened to run into Washington Post correspondent Mike Allen outside on the White House grounds, and I told him as well. That made four reporters from four top national media organizations, plenty to get the news out, especially with it getting on the AP wire for all media to see. I told each that Scooter had assured me he neither leaked the classified information nor would he condone it, and made sure the press duty officer for the day was aware so as not to be caught blindsided if other media outlets called seeking to match their competitors. Sure enough, pretty soon it was on the Associated Press newswire as part of a larger story on the leak investigation. I was glad to see it handled that way. It meant I'd managed to get the news about my official defense of Scooter out without drawing too much extra attention to it. A short time later, I learned from Sean McCormick, another of my deputies and the chief spokesman for the National Security Council, that Elliot Abrams, a senior National Security Council staffer, had denied any involvement to a reporter who had contacted him directly because of rumors. It's a sadly typical tactic used by some of the less scrupulous partisan activists in Washington during a time of scandal. Float a rumor in the media and see if it sticks. There was zero information to suggest Elliott was involved in the disclosure of Plame's identity, but he was considered a leading neoconservative foreign policy hawk and was an early advocate of regime change in Iraq. He'd also been pardoned by the first President Bush for two misdemeanor pleas for withholding information from Congress during the infamous Iran-Contra scandal. For these reasons, he was always an easy target for unsubstantiated allegations. As far as I was concerned, Elliott was a seasoned foreign policy expert and helpful colleague who always shot straight with me, including that day. I contacted him and got the same assurances, and thought I'd better go ahead and get his denials out to the same reporters I'd spoken to about Scooter, since Elliott had already spoken to one anyway. Better to get it all out at once in the same news cycle, as opposed to one today, one tomorrow, and so on. So I called the same reporters back. I was becoming increasingly frustrated, as this was exactly what I didn't want to happen. I was putting myself in the middle of the investigation by publicly vouching for people, against my own wishes, and against the sound advice of White House counsel. The following week, the press questions were back to the usual wide range of topics in the gaggles and briefings, but the leak investigation remained in the mix. Meanwhile, White House aides, including me, each in his or her own way, were sorting through their electronic records, correspondence, telephone logs, calendars, and notes, and then copying anything that might be relevant under the broadly encompassing specifications of the Justice Department request. On Monday, in response to follow-up questions, I confirmed at the briefing that I had spoken with Carl, Scooter, and Elliott, and that each had denied any involvement in the leaking of Plame's identity. As I'd suspected they would, reporters wondered why I'd questioned these three particular staff members, and why the president was not demanding that other staff members be asked the same question. I did some verbal dancing in response, knowing I was not authorized to get into the full backstory. In hindsight, the president should have overruled his advisors and demanded that an internal investigation be conducted to determine whether there might have been any White House involvement. He also should have ordered the public release of as much information as possible as soon as it was known, so that the scandal would not take on a life of its own. But he chose not to do so, perhaps feeling that keeping clear of the story would insulate him and protect him from potential political damage. Instead, it gave the story broader and longer life, only helping to reinforce the permanent state of suspicion and partisan warfare he had pledged to move Washington beyond. Dan Bartlett later shared with me that David Addington, the vice president's counsel, had expressed concern after learning that I had publicly exonerated Scooter. Addington specifically warned Bartlett that I should not be out there talking about the investigation or discussing what anyone had done or not done. Bartlett responded, "It was your boss who told us to." I grimaced ever so briefly as Dan and I shook our heads. We were a bit incredulous. Addington is publicly perceived as one of the most secretive officials in the White House. Over time, however, I would find that he was also one of the most helpful to me. He shared information or advice privately so that I would not misstep publicly as press secretary. Nothing was more important to me than getting the full picture when seeking information from a colleague. It was not always easy in a White House where some cared little for the press or viewed it as another special interest. But David was considerate of my need to be fully briefed on things in order to be effective and accurate. If he knew something he felt would help, he did not need prompting to share it or a game of 20 questions to guess it. Unfortunately, Addington's advice was apparently neither heard nor heeded by those pushing me further into the abyss I had already unwittingly stepped into. At the Friday, October 10th briefing, I made my final comments about Rove's and Libby's assurances. Soon, FBI agents and Justice Department prosecutors would begin interviewing White House officials. I talked with Alan David about my personal situation after being contacted by the FBI. After reminding me that neither he nor Al was my personal attorney, David remarked, "This is not like being the White House spokesman. You want to answer questions completely and openly, as opposed to only the limited information you might share as a spokesman. You don't necessarily have to volunteer information beyond what they ask, but you need to be candid and responsive to what they do ask. The advice came as no surprise, but it was helpful to have it reinforced beforehand. Al and David also offered to provide someone from their office to sit in on any conversations I might have with the FBI. I realized this would also be a convenient way for them to keep tabs on the investigation and any possible fallout for the president. Nevertheless, I was glad to take them up on their offer. Within days, I had my first meeting with FBI agents in a second-floor conference room the counsel's office had set aside in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building on the White House grounds, just across the West Executive driveway from the West Wing staff entrance. The high-ceilinged room was lit by large windows on one side. Other than that, there was just a large wooden conference table surrounded by leather chairs. John Eckenrode, the special agent in charge of the investigation for the FBI from day one, led the discussion. He was joined by two other agents who were seated on the side of the table facing the door. I was on the other side, facing the windows behind them. They had been provided copies of all the documents from my work files that I had turned over to the counsel's office the second week in October. I remember one email I'd handed over from a friend of my personal assistant, Carmen Ingwell. Carmen's friend had attended a class or lecture event at a California university a few years earlier featuring Joe Wilson, during which, she said, Wilson had mentioned that his wife worked for the CIA. I had no idea whether the story was true or not. It was early in the investigation, and the agents seemed to be focused on learning about how the White House, including the White House communications team, operated and interacted with the media. Ted Ulliott, a smart, capable, 30-something attorney in the White House counsel's office, listened in as I answered questions. I already knew Ted a little from working with him on other issues, and he had always come across as open and helpful. He and his colleague Raoul Yanes had been tasked as the point people for the investigation in the counsel's office. I came to know Ted and Raoul better during that time, and I thought that Al and David could not have chosen two finer individuals for such a controversial, high-profile task. After that first meeting with FBI investigators, I remember saying to Ted as we walked down the executive office building hallway back to the West Wing, I was surprised they didn't ask any substantive questions about what I might know, such as my conversations with Rove and Libby. The second meeting, I believe within a couple of weeks, was more targeted to what I might know. Neither meeting lasted much more than an hour. On December 30, 2003, Deputy Attorney General Jim Comey held a news conference at the Department of Justice. He announced that Attorney General John Ashcroft had recused himself from the investigation to avoid any appearance of conflict of interest. Comey then announced that he was naming a special prosecutor to oversee the leak investigation, Patrick J. Fitzgerald of Chicago. Fitzgerald was a highly regarded U.S. attorney who had a reputation for playing by the book and not being swayed by politics. Comey would not publicly discuss what had led to the decision to appoint the special counsel, except to say that an accumulation of facts over the previous several months had led to the decision. We don't want people that we might be interested in to know that we're interested in them. We also don't want to smear somebody who might be innocent and might not be charged. Ron Roos, the deputy to the head of the Justice Department's counter-espionage unit run by John Dionne, contacted me to arrange a time to meet with the team overseeing the investigation days before I was subpoenaed to appear before the grand jury. This time he asked if I would come alone, without anyone from the counsel's office. They preferred to talk to me alone, he indicated. I agreed. It made little difference to me one way or the other, although I appreciated hearing any feedback Ted was able to offer. I suspected that the investigative team wanted to keep information as closely held as possible as they proceeded with grand jury testimony. Early on, when I knew that I would be questioned in light of my public exonerations of Rove, Libby, and Abrams, I consulted my sister-in-law Stephanie McClellan, a former assistant district attorney in San Jose County, and my brother Dudley, a former clerk to a federal judge in Austin. Stephanie thought I should hire an attorney, even though I told her I did not know anything about the actual leak and that my role was limited to defending the White House and a couple of staffers after the fact. She perceptively pointed out that one can never know with certainty how words spoken might be construed or, worse, twisted particularly in the context of a high-profile political investigation taking place during an election campaign. Dudley was noncommittal, just advising me as a brother and knowledgeable attorney on the pros of hiring counsel. I would later ask him some basic substantive questions. He, his twin Bradley, and our eldest brother, Mark, may have picked on me growing up, but we are as close as any brothers can be. It was reassuring to know I could call on him when push came to shove. Colleagues thought I would be crazy not to hire an attorney. My deputy, Claire Buchan, a good friend who always looked out for me, basically said, "You have to hire an attorney." However, unlike many of my colleagues, I decided not to. I would tell investigators the truth, what I knew and what I remembered. With nothing to hide, with my only involvement coming in the aftermath of the leak, I felt comfortable with the decision. I don't mean to imply that my colleagues had something to hide. I'm just expressing my own feeling about the decision. So there I was that cold afternoon at the counter-espionage unit's office, several floors up in a Justice Department office building a few blocks from the White House. The conference room where we met was rather dark. The table was long. I saw the FBI agents who had previously interviewed me. Ron Roos introduced himself and the others present. I sat at the center of the table, across from the FBI agents, as I had in the previous meetings in the executive office building. Prosecutorial team members sat across the table as well as to my right. Fitzgerald was not in the room. While the previous meetings were straightforward and free of tension, this one started differently. Roos, who struck me as a serious and professional prosecutor, asked why I had exonerated Rove and Libby. Then he asked why I had not mentioned in the first meeting that Carl had spoken to Novak. Somewhat taken aback, I looked at one of the FBI agents and said, "I told you all when you asked me in the second meeting, you didn't ask about it in the first meeting." The agent said nothing. I thought, okay, they're playing tough to make sure I've told them everything I know or can recall, and to make sure they have been thorough in seeking to learn the truth. A few minutes later, Peter Zeidenberg, a prosecutor from the Public Integrity Unit, entered the room. He introduced himself and seemed friendly. Professional and courteous, he quickly won my respect and trust. He played good cop to Roos's bad cop, indicating they were just trying to verify facts. He said he had seen many times how a witness's memory can be hazy when they're asked to recollect something that happened weeks or months earlier, and they just wanted to make sure they talked to me before my grand jury appearance. From his comments, I assumed he had been watching the initial discussion through what appeared to be a one-way window to my right, like one would see on the television show Law and Order. The meeting did not last much longer, and I was soon back at the White House to tend to my press secretary duties. Still, I wondered about their initial hard-edged approach. I felt a little unsettled, since I'd always been fully cooperative and open with them. I imagine they used the tactic to try to rattle those being questioned to see if they were being truthful. But I was comforted by the way the meeting had ended and felt they had reassured themselves I had nothing to hide. My appearance before a federal grand jury loomed before me. As I sensed was true of my colleagues, it weighed on my mind because of the high-stakes nature of the investigation. White House staffers long ago had stopped talking to one another about anything specific related to the leak investigation, including whether they'd been questioned and whether or not they'd hired an attorney. As with any high-profile Washington investigation, almost every White House aide going before the grand jury hired a lawyer out of an abundance of caution, even if they knew they were not involved. About the only thing I heard from colleagues was when they were headed to the grand jury, since the press was camped out by the grand jury room on a daily basis, and my colleagues did not want me to be blindsided by hearing it from a reporter first. Besides the silence we shared, we also sensed the same anxiety hanging over us. Somewhat unnerved, I wondered, was Stephanie's advice right? Should I be leaning on an attorney's advice? When you agree to work for the President of the United States, you don't picture being interrogated by the FBI or testifying before a grand jury under threat of perjury as part of the job description. The grand jury reportedly began hearing testimony in late January 2004. I was called to appear before the jurors on Friday afternoon, February 6th. I met Roos and one of the agents outside in the hallway in the upstairs area of the Prettyman Federal Courthouse building, near the Capitol on Pennsylvania Avenue. The afternoon weather was overcast and cold, although not unusually so for Washington that time of year. There was a little drizzle of rain now and then. They told me they would be ready for me soon and just to hang tight. Both were very friendly that afternoon. I sat in a chair in the barren, ill-lit hallway. I walked to the grand jury room through a narrow, short hall. Not quite sure what to expect, I entered the room and was directed to sit down in a wooden chair near the door at the short end of an L-shaped table. The prosecutorial team was to my right, facing the jurors, who was seated, theater-style, in front and above us. At a guess, I'd say there were 35 or 40 jurors present. Across the way, a stenographer took down everything I was asked and said. Zeidenberg, the Public Integrity Unit prosecutor, asked the questions. Given where my chair was positioned, it was hard to know who exactly was present, and no introductions were made. Maybe Patrick Fitzgerald, the man I felt I now knew from all the press attention he'd received, but had not yet met, was there, but I did not see him. I was focused on answering questions. I turned slightly to the left so I could partially face the jury while looking at Zeidenberg. The first thing he asked was whether it was correct that I was not represented by counsel. I indicated that I had not hired an attorney, but had just talked a few times with my brother Dudley. Then we went through a series of questions before the grand jury, most of which I had answered on previous occasions, including accounts of my conversations with Carl and Scooter, and the assurances they'd provided me that they were not involved in the leaking of Plame's identity. But there were a couple of questions they had not previously asked me. Zeidenberg asked whether I'd told Condi Rice that she should say that Carl was not involved before she went on the Sunday talk shows back on September 28, 2003. Rice hadn't, in fact, addressed this specific matter on those shows. I thought hard. I knew I'd spoken to Condi that Saturday, the same Saturday I'd called Rove after first learning that he'd spoken to Novak and he'd assured me he had not been involved in leaking classified information, as I usually did with administration officials ahead of their Sunday show appearances. It was a way to prep them for responses to likely questions and make sure everyone was on the same page. We knew the Sunday Post piece would likely prompt questions about possible White House involvement in the leak. Had I coached Condi on what to say about Karl Rove? I said I might have, but could not remember with certainty. I indicated it was more likely I told her what I'd said publicly and suggested she could refer back to what I'd said without getting into it herself. After hearing the second new question, I was momentarily taken aback. Zeidenberg asked if it was true the president told me in the Oval Office that Karl Rove told him he was not involved. It was the first time I'd been asked about something the president knew or said. Since the president had not been questioned yet, I knew that Andy must have discussed it with investigators at some earlier point. Knowing the president's preference that his private conversations remain private, I hesitated momentarily, but this was different. I knew forthrightness was the only option. A frog in my throat, I managed to confirm that the president had indeed made such a statement. Zeidenberg wrapped up his questioning and asked jurors if they had any questions. Only a young African-American woman seated at the far end of the room in the first row had a question. She asked me to define what background, deep background, and off the record meant to me. I responded by saying that the terms meant slightly different things to different reporters. My understanding, I said, is that background means a reporter can quote you but not reference you by name. The reporter and the source will usually agree as to what the attribution should be. A senior White House official, a senior administration official, or if the source wants to have more distance, maybe a Republican official or a U.S. government official. As for deep background, most reporters view it as information they can use in their reporting but can't attribute in any way or directly quote the source. And off the record means to me that the reporter can't use the information in any way in his reporting. The session was over within an hour. Roos and one of the agents thanked me as they walked me back out to the hallway. They also said that while I was legally free to talk about it, they would prefer that I keep my grand jury testimony private. As I headed toward the stairs, a journalist standing in the hallway recognized me and followed me down the stairs. She introduced herself as a CBS producer and asked where my attorney was. I looked behind me and playfully said, "I don't know, you didn't see him back there?" After she looked around for a few seconds, I said I didn't have one. She expressed surprise since everyone else she had seen come in did. A few other reporters were gathered just outside the courthouse, trying to get some cover from the day's light drizzle. I put on a nonchalant smile as I stopped to answer a few questions. "Just glad to do my part to fully cooperate with the investigation, as the president directed us to do," I said before getting into my car. The investigation continued for months, without causing any real distraction during the successful re-election campaign. Still, White House staff would not speak with one another about it. The counsel's office had long ago put the kibosh on anyone talking publicly about it, including myself. And privately, people had spent enough money on attorneys and enough time responding to investigators that no one wanted to do anything that might cause more of our government paychecks and already stretched schedules to be eaten up. I imagine some people slipped at times and found themselves complaining about their hours before the grand jury or gossiping about whodunit. On a few occasions, even the president couldn't help himself. I remember hearing him in the Oval or on Air Force One grousing about having to hire an attorney and about the atmospherics of being questioned. The president was interviewed by Patrick Fitzgerald and some of his team for about 70 minutes in the Oval in late June 2004. Shooter, as the president nicknamed his private lawyer, Jim Sharp, was also present. Al Gonzalez had testified to the grand jury several days earlier, and the vice president had been interviewed at the beginning of June. I have no knowledge of what any of them told prosecutors. Karl Rove's first appearance before the grand jury was on October 15, 2004. Coming just weeks before Election Day, it was used by Democrats as an opportunity to take shots at the president. The Kerry campaign, seeking any political mileage they could get at that late stage in the game, called for Rove and the White House to come clean about their role in this insidious act. It would be Rove's only grand jury appearance before the election, but it would not be his last. From the outset of the investigation, the president had made a decision not to pursue the matter internally. He said he wanted to get to the bottom of questionable activity surrounding the leak episode, but he did not order any White House staff members to mount an investigation, nor to take any other proactive steps to uncover the truth or inform the public. At least in part, on the advice of White House lawyers and other key advisors, he chose to leave the leak and its consequences solely to the special counsel. The approach stood in stark contrast to the way the White House had approached the 16 words controversy that led to the scandal. In that case, once the decision had been made to determine how the words had made it into the presidential address, we got to the bottom of what happened fairly quickly and shared information as completely as possible. By approaching the controversy openly and forthrightly, we shortened its shelf life in the news and diminished any momentum for the outside investigation on the specific controversy at the time that congressional Democrats initially advocated it. But when it came to the disclosure of Plame's identity, we left it to outside inquiries by reporters and prosecutors, allowing the matter to harden into a permanent state of suspicion and warfare, as Bob Woodward, in Shadow, described the legacy of Watergate and its effect on Nixon's successors. The risk of taking this approach should have been clear, but in the bubble of the White House, sometimes you learn the wrong lessons of history and fail to recognize this reality. You become so focused on protecting the president, you don't realize you're rolling the dice and losing control of the problem. I didn't know anything about the leak or its causes. Uninformed about efforts to discredit Wilson, I simply assumed the best about them and key advisors to the president. I believed, based in no small part on the categorical assurances I'd received from Libby and Rove, that the White House had not been involved in leaking classified information or creating an environment that led to its disclosure. Sadly, I eventually learned otherwise. Would I have pushed for addressing the matter openly and directly if I'd been more knowledgeable about the facts and circumstances, if I'd been on the job longer, or if I'd had previous experience with criminal investigations? I like to think so. I've always believed the term "no comment" is a terrible communication strategy. It inevitably comes across as suspicious and defensive. But in this case, I went along with the decision that was in place. Now I wish I hadn't. During the 2000 campaign, candidate George W. Bush had pledged to be different, but at the White House, he chose to be the same. Just as the Clinton presidency had done when it came to questionable activity, we perpetuated the endless investigations and scandals we'd vowed to move beyond by engaging in spin, stonewalling, hedging, evasion, denial, non-communication, and deceit by omission. The decision to invade Iraq, more than anything else, took the Bush presidency off course, and our excessive embrace of the political tactics at the heart of Washington's culture of deception kept it there. when candor could have helped minimize the political fallout from the unraveling of the chief rationale for war, spin and evasion were instead what we employed. While those tactics worked to our short-term advantage and did nothing to hurt the president's re-election cause, our primary objective at the beginning, the longer-term effect was to undermine his presidency and to keep Washington from moving beyond the partisan warfare that had engulfed it years before. As for Patrick Fitzgerald, the special counsel, he was determined to do only one thing, his job. That meant not worrying about the partisan back and forth or any artificial timetables for getting to the truth in Washington's otherwise truth-deficient culture. Unknown to anyone outside his determined team of professionals, obstruction of justice charges were already being considered against at least one and possibly two White House officials. In the grand scheme of things, the leak episode didn't help our efforts to address the challenges and problems in Iraq or the volatile Middle East or our own security interests there. It just served to perpetuate Washington's destructive culture of deception, rooted in the partisan warfare embraced by our elected leaders in Washington. All of this at a time when America's men and women in uniform were fighting abroad, hoping only to return home one day and reunite with loved ones. But those of us at the White House during that time can only fault ourselves for all the attention the leak received. The lack of openness, forthrightness, and straightforward honesty to this day still fuels critics and raises questions about the president's truthfulness and honesty, traits at one time perceived to be among his greatest personal attributes. And through it all, ironically, the White House successfully kept the potentially most embarrassing and damaging issue for the president from being closely scrutinized, the larger issue at the heart of the original 16-word controversy. How policymakers used the intelligence on Iraq to make the case that Iraq was a grave and gathering threat, sufficient to justify a preemptive war. Questions surrounding that larger issue are paramount to understanding the decision to invade Iraq and its lessons for history. Exploring those questions and the decision by the president and his key advisors to avoid the potential consequences of openness and forthrightness about them is also at the heart of understanding what took his presidency off course and prevented it from getting back on track. Instead of embracing candor and honesty when they were most needed and using them to his advantage, the president decided to avoid them for fear of political damage. His advisors went along with his decision. The result would be a sustained loss of standing with the public and a president left clinging to the belief that history and posterity will overlook the inherent deception in such an approach and burnish his legacy if his vision of success in Iraq can ultimately be achieved. But I wouldn't come to realize any of this for many months. Back in late 2004, the president was on his way to making history another way, by winning a prized second term. Chapter 13, Triumph and Illusion. I headed to the Oval Office late on the morning of November 3, 2004. I was expecting to witness the president receiving a concession call from his re-election opponent, Senator John Kerry. It had been a long night. Even the usually early-to-bed Bush had stayed up until 5 a.m., about the time he typically would awake, and was operating on about 2 hours' sleep. I had left the White House around 5:30 a.m. and returned a few hours later. The day before had reminded me a bit of Election Day 2000, only this time the drama centered on Ohio, not Florida. In the late afternoon, just before polls around the country started to close, the mood was grim. The President and Mrs. Bush had voted in Crawford and then stopped in Ohio before Air Force One transported them and their daughters and those of us on the senior staff with him back to Washington. Before we jumped into the staff vans to take us back to the White House, Dan Bartlett heard from Karl Rove, who had received word from the president's chief pollster, Matthew Dowd, that exit polls spelled trouble for the president. The grim diagnosis left all of us in the upper echelons of Bush world feeling anxious. But by evening, our mood had begun to change. When results in states like South Carolina and Virginia started coming in, it was clear the exit polls were off base. Things were tight, but seemed to be tilting our way. Cautious optimism permeated the atmosphere. I alternated between my West Wing office and the adjacent Roosevelt Room, which had been set up for the senior staff victory watch party. My wife Jill and I, we'd been married the previous November, enjoyed visiting with former President George H.W. Bush for several minutes when he popped in to say hello to the assembled advisors. Jill, who had never met him personally, was thrilled to talk with the warm, gracious, elder statesman. The current president was following the news from the private residence in the White House with immediate and extended family, parents, siblings, and their spouses, as well as several longtime friends. Later, I headed over to the old family dining room, just below the private residence, which Karl Rove had arranged to use as the election night war room. It was conveniently located just a staircase away from the president if he decided to check in personally. He did just that several times during the evening, while maintaining continuous contact with Karl by phone. On one side of the room were tables with several computers where staffers, including Rove, could monitor state-by-state results. On the other were large flat-screen TVs tuned in to the network political coverage. The original plan was to limit access to the room to a few key political aides, Rove, his top assistants Israel Hernandez and Susan Ralston, and a handful of others. But as the night progressed and the election race continued neck and neck, some other senior White House staff arrived to get the up-to-the-minute scoop about where things were headed. I was one. Near midnight, the network started calling Florida for Bush. The old family dining room was filled with cheers and excitement. Although the numbers-crunching Rove felt we had won Ohio too, none of the stations were close to calling it yet. Andy Card had already begun reaching out to the Kerry campaign, delicately taking its pulse and gently encouraging them to consider making the dreaded concession call. A victory party was underway in the atrium of the Ronald Reagan building just down the street. At the White House, we were all hoping that we'd soon be able to celebrate and watch the president give a victory speech. But still, the night dragged on. The wee hours of the morning arrived, and the national networks, perhaps overly cautious after having been badly burned in 2000, were still hesitating to call Ohio with its crucial cargo of electoral votes. As we headed into the 4 a.m. hour, we felt that our cushion of about 150,000 votes in Ohio would give us the state and the election. But the networks were still holding back, and Kerry and some in his campaign were still holding out hope that Ohio's provisional ballots would somehow turn it around. At the White House, a few advisors wanted Bush to declare victory without a concession by Kerry. They hoped this move would discourage Democrats from bringing in the lawyers and turning 2004 into a new version of 2000. But others urged Bush to wait, and that's how matters stood when the president called it a night and headed up to the residence at 5 a.m. Word had filtered back to us confidentially via Mike McCurry of the Kerry campaign that if we just gave Kerry some time to reflect, he would come around. Later that morning, he did. When I arrived back at the White House that morning, after a couple hours of rest, I immediately popped into the Oval to see the president. "Congratulations, sir," I said. "Nice win." "Thanks, Scott," Bush replied. "You did a great job, a really great job." A little later, Rove, Karen Hughes, Dan Bartlett, Chief Speechwriter Mike Gerson, and I were visiting with the president in the Oval. We were expecting Kerry's call at any moment. Don Rumsfeld, grinning ear to ear, popped his head in briefly to congratulate the president. At 11:02 a.m., Bush's assistant, Ashley Estes, appeared. "Mr. President, Senator Kerry is on the line." The president walked back to his desk to sit down and pick up the phone. We could only hear Bush's side of the conversation. "I think you were an admirable, worthy opponent. You waged one tough campaign. I hope you're proud of the effort you put in. You should be." When Bush hung up after 3 or 4 minutes, he said, slightly choking up, "That was very gracious." Then he started to tear up. It was a sentimental moment. Bush had secured a place in history by winning a coveted second term. He started hugging each of us as our eyes also began to well up. The embraces were warm and heartfelt. Within minutes, Andy Card arrived to join the hug fest, along with Joe Hagan, Blake Gottesman, and Ashley. Bush then went down the hall to the vice president's office, and the two congratulated each other. Mrs. Bush called just after he left, and a short time later, Bush went to the residence to see her and get in a workout before his afternoon victory speech. I remember pulling up underneath the Reagan building in the motorcade that afternoon for the celebration. The staff vans were packed full with joyful senior staff. This was a time for us to enjoy the moment of euphoria we'd been deprived of 4 years earlier. Inside, the building was packed with cheering supporters and staff. Bush's remarks were brief. He thanked his supporters and staff, singling out a few, like the architect, Karl Rove, and reached out to those who supported his opponent. He talked about the record turnout and the historic victory. And then he turned to the agenda for a second term. "Because we have done the hard work, we are entering a season of hope," he said. He pledged to build on the recent economic progress, reform the tax code, strengthen Social Security, and continue improving public schools. He also reaffirmed a commitment to helping the emerging democracies in Iraq and Afghanistan, and to continuing the war on terrorism. Befitting the occasion, it was an upbeat, hopeful speech, filled with expectation about the great accomplishments he looked forward to during his second term. The next morning, Dan held a communications team celebration in the Roosevelt Room. The president made a brief surprise visit to thank everyone for their work. As he finished, he gave me a shout-out. "Where's Scott?" he asked. "Is he here?" Some others pointed to me. "I especially want to thank Scott," Bush continued. "Scott did a great job. You didn't make any news," he added in his jocular mood. "I want to thank you for saying nothing." The line got the chuckle it deserved, but it also reflected Bush's sentiment about not wanting his press secretary stirring up controversy unnecessarily, particularly in the heat of a campaign. He'd used a similar line at Ari Fleischer's departure party, saying he'd done a great job of saying nothing at all. Mid-morning, Bush held a cabinet meeting. "I expect there to be lots of rumors and speculation about changes in the cabinet for our second term," he began. "Well, a few changes are very likely, but I haven't had time to think about them yet." Then he talked about the second term agenda. He talked about the Medicare prescription drug benefit, soon to go into effect, and the need to make sure that the projected savings for seniors became real and true. On the domestic front, education had helped Bush win the election, neutralizing a typically Democratic issue, or even turning it into a Republican strength, he said, "because we have a vision and philosophy." The second term would be a chance to solidify Bush's place in history. Retooling Democratic ideas of education, Medicare, and Social Security along conservative lines could take away Democratic dominance on these core issues for years to come, or so Bush and Karl Rove believed. With Republican majorities in the House and Senate, the two men, especially Rove, relished the prospect of launching a new era of Republican dominance as part of their legacy. The president told the cabinet he would push for medical liability reform, insist on fiscal discipline, seek an energy bill, and then turn to the three biggest domestic initiatives: Social Security, tax reform, and budgetary reform. Most important, Bush indicated that his approach to governing would be much the same as it had been during his first term. The permanent campaign would continue. "How we sell the big items is going to be very important as we move forward," Bush declared. "We already sold the American people on the agenda," he added, referring to the election victory. Now, he assured the cabinet, when it came to promoting his biggest agenda items, "we are going to go for it." The focus would be on swaying public opinion and thereby pressuring Congress to get on board. It was a philosophy of governance he shared with the powerful Rove, to whom he now turned. Bush praised Rove as a brilliant architect who'd come up with a perfect strategy for the re-election and had run a perfect campaign. "It was incredibly well managed. We had huge, magnificent crowds." It went without saying that the architect would now be turning his attention to running the campaign to sell the big items to the American people. It was as if Election Day merely represented a way station on a never-ending journey. Then Dick Cheney made some brief remarks. He recalled discussing plans with President Bush at the same time 4 years earlier. "I remember our conversation coming off the recount of 2000 about whether to trim the cells," the vice president said. "You said it was not an option, and it paid off. This time around, the mandate was clear." The narrowness of the victory, one of the smallest margins for any re-election bid in presidential history, went unnoticed in the talk of a mandate. Cheney added that the next 4 years were an opportunity to complete the task. The conversation turned to Iraq. "Iraq is foremost in our minds," Secretary Powell said of the State Department. "We are working toward elections in 05. The insurgency must be put down, particularly in the Sunni triangle." The president interjected. "It was a defining moment in Afghanistan when elections took place. You've got to have faith that people want to be free, even in impoverished areas. Iraq will change the world. but he acknowledged achieving the results you want can sometimes be ugly. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld referred to military families and parents. "I kept thinking about them," he said. "The election ending must be enormously reassuring to them." He talked about how the Iraqi people were resisting intimidation amid the tough stuff they faced, vaguely alluding, like Powell, to the chaotic and deadly situation in areas like Fallujah, where terrorists and insurgents were causing mayhem. And he also stressed the importance of the upcoming January Iraqi election to elect a transitional National Assembly. The president agreed. "Elections are important," he said. "It forces people to make a choice. Either they miss the train or get on the train of democracy." Bush added that he had spoken with Iraqi leaders Yawar and Alawi about the U.S. election results and said they were relieved about Bush's victory. "They were toast if you lost," Rumsfeld said. "French toast," replied Bush to a burst of laughter in the room. The victory speech and cabinet meeting made Bush's state of mind crystal clear to anyone who knew him. He was dead set on pushing ahead aggressively, selling his big ideas, and leaving his mark on history. The election, he believed, had validated his first-term policies, including the decision to invade Iraq, and it had given him a mandate for the second-term agenda he'd outlined. Now, all he had to do was what he did best: campaign. He would travel the country, shaping the media narrative to his advantage and winning the battle for public opinion one voter, one poll, one state at a time. Soon, Congress would be forced to come to the table and negotiate on Bush's terms. Bipartisan give and take and compromise from the outset would be unnecessary. Those techniques, so vital to Bush's success in Texas, were irrelevant to the Washington game. The same spirit was obvious in Bush's first post-election news conference. He expressed his intent to spend his political capital in pursuit of an ambitious agenda, beginning with overhauling Social Security. When pressed about working with Democrats, Bush said he was willing to do so. He even made passing reference to the theme of uniting the country, on which he'd run 4 years earlier. "One of the disappointments of being here in Washington is how bitter this town can become and how divisive," said Bush. "I'm not blaming one party or the other. It's just the reality of Washington, D.C., sometimes exacerbated by you, the media, because it's great sport. It's entertaining for some. It also makes it difficult to govern at times. But nevertheless, my commitment is there to work with Democrats." But Bush also made it clear that if he had to push something through with little Democratic support, as he'd done with the Medicare prescription drug bill, he would do that. "Results really do matter," he said, and it was clear that for Bush, results meant getting his agenda through the way he and Rove envisioned it, not a watered-down version tainted by Democratic input. In hindsight, the commitment to transcending partisanship was largely perfunctory. Of course, Iraq was still a top priority. In his press conference, the president articulated the same view he and his national security team spoke about in private. It was just a matter of time before democracy took hold in Iraq. Then Iraqis would step forward and assume responsibility for their own security, and the drawdown of American troops could begin in earnest. The upcoming January elections were being viewed as a milestone moment in this process. "We will work with the Alawi government," Bush said, "to achieve our objective, which is elections on the path to stability, and we'll continue to train the troops. Our commanders will have that which they need to complete their missions." It was all part of Bush's idealistic vision of Iraq as a launching pad for transforming the Middle East. He defended that vision in his press conference. "There's a certain attitude in the world by some that says that it's a waste of time to try to promote free societies in parts of the world," he said. "I've heard that criticism. I just strongly disagree with those who do not see the wisdom of trying to promote free societies around the world. If we are interested in protecting our country for the long term, the best way to do so is to promote freedom and democracy." The agenda for the second term was nothing if not ambitious: to reform some of America's biggest and most controversial domestic programs, to create the conditions for a lasting Republican majority, and to simultaneously bring a major foreign war to a successful conclusion, thereby beginning the transformation of a volatile region into an oasis of peace and democracy. But Bush and those of us on his team were confident. "We put faith in the president's hands-off leadership style, which left many of the crucial details to his trusted team of subordinates. Unlike Presidents Johnson and Carter, who'd gotten lost in the weeds thanks to their penchant for micromanaging, Bush would stick to the big picture. and so achieve success on multiple fronts at once. Bush's top policy and strategy advisors believe they understood the reality of how to win the Washington way, but was their self-confidence in our mandate illusory? Had they succumbed to one of the perennial dangers faced by successful campaigners, believing their own spin and ignoring just how shaky public support was for Bush? The next couple of years would tell the tale. For now, an eager and determined Bush and a re-energized White House team were triumphantly charging forward. Bush left for Camp David with Mrs. Bush that Thursday afternoon to clear his head and relax after a grueling campaign, but he would also begin serious discussions with Andy Card about the cabinet and White House staff. A number of cabinet members were planning on leaving, and Andy would encourage a few others to see the benefits of submitting resignation letters rather than waiting to be dismissed. Periodic change is critical to any effective White House. A president needs a diversity of advice that is informed, honest, and clear-sighted. Fresh blood can help keep these sources vibrant and energetic. Furthermore, working as a member of the senior White House staff is all-consuming and exhausting, a well-worn path to burnout. And the longer you remain inside the White House bubble, the harder it becomes to see things clearly and objectively. So knowing when and how to implement change is critical for a president and his chief of staff. Andy Card understood all this. He'd warned many of us future West Wingers from the outset that one of the most important things we needed to know was when to leave. Now he set out to Camp David to encourage the president to start this process by bringing in a new chief of staff. I stayed in close contact with Andy throughout the planning period. The Washington rumor mill was already beginning to speculate about the changes to come, and I didn't want to be blindsided at a press briefing by any sudden moves. At the same time, I understood that this would be a tightly compartmentalized process. The president believed in keeping plans confidential until they were finalized. Andy and the president would seek ideas from trusted advisors. The White House counsel's office would quietly vet any potential new faces. Specific names would usually circulate within the inner circle, which is when I would usually find out, if not from the president himself. The goal was to make most of the changes around the same time and to have a complete second-term cabinet in place before the end of the year. On Friday at Camp David, the president also participated in a national security meeting on Iraq. Via secure video conference, General Abizaid, the head of Central Command, General Casey, the head of the Iraqi theater, and John Negroponte, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, offered their perspectives. A priority topic of discussion was the situation in the city of Fallujah, an area of concern ever since the end of the first battles there months earlier. Insurgents still controlled the city, and Bush and his team had decided that they must be defeated once and for all before the upcoming elections. That first week in November, Prime Minister Maliki had publicly warned the insurgents that their window for reaching a peaceful settlement with the government was closing fast. U.S. forces had already begun pounding the city with airstrikes and artillery fire. Now, American forces were about to be joined by Iraqi forces in bloody, intense urban warfare under the name of Operation Phantom Fury. They would gain firm control of the city within several days and move to mop-up operations by the middle of the month. But during that same period, increased violence broke out in other parts of Iraq, such as the city of Mosul. It was the beginning of what some have called the whack-a-mole period of the battle against insurgents. Knock them down in one place, and they pop up somewhere else. The following Monday morning, after the president returned from Camp David, he made a rare visit to the senior staff meeting in the Roosevelt Room. "I've made one decision," he said. "I've asked Andy to remain as chief of staff." The senior staff applauded, and Andy expressed how honored he was. The message here was one of continuity, not change. I have great admiration for Andy Card, and I always considered him one of the most honorable public servants in the Bush administration. Andy himself had believed the White House would be better served by a change at the chief of staff position. As Andy later told me, he'd urged the president to make such a change, only to have the suggestion firmly rejected. In hindsight, it foreshadowed what was to come in the way of second-term change. People used to ask me why Bush's staff was so loyal to him. I would reply, "We are loyal to him, but he is also loyal to us. It is a two-way street, and our mutual loyalties feed each other." Bush lacks familiarity and does not like change, especially in regard to key staff members he has come to trust and rely on. This has led to a close bond between Bush and a number of us senior staffers, particularly fellow Texans and people like Andy. His personal charm and approachable demeanor also make for an enjoyable working environment where people want to stick around, maybe longer than they should. It's a great personal strength of George W. Bush that he is able to inspire such loyalty. But for President Bush, it is also a potential source of weakness. Bush's discomfort with change makes it difficult for him to step back from the bonds he develops and make clear-eyed decisions about what is best. In hindsight, it's apparent that an opportunity was missed at the start of the second term to bring people with new perspectives onto the White House staff and the national security team. Instead, we saw the consolidation of an even more like-minded team within the cabinet and White House, particularly among the national security principals. There were changes, but they only increased the homogeneity of opinion among those with the president's ear. Secretary of State Colin Powell was out. Card later told me that Powell and Bush had previously agreed he would serve only until the end of the first term. By the time the transition came, Powell had reconsidered and was at least open to staying longer under certain conditions. But after meeting to discuss it, both men agreed the time for parting had come. Like much of the country, I was sorry to see Powell go. I always knew him to offer straight, unvarnished advice based on his years of experience as a military and foreign policy leader. What's more, he never hesitated to make his position clear. President Bush, however, apparently felt no continued need for Powell's moderate voice to counter the more hawkish views of Cheney and Rumsfeld. He would be replaced by the fully trusted and sometimes too accommodating Condi Rice, who was more than ready for a change from her position as National Security Advisor. That job had been fraught with enormous challenge and pressure, and more recently, growing controversy over Iraq. I could tell she was eager to start anew in another capacity, and Secretary of State was the only job she was interested in, as far as I could see. Some on the Bush team, including the president,